Okay, if you will, look there at verse 1, First Peter chapter 5, verse 1. The Apostle Peter writing to the elders who are among you in exhortation. He said, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Now, the first question that we have dealing with that section of our study is to explain the difference between overseeing by example, as indicated in verse 3, with the type of oversight that could be described as lording it over those who are entrusted to you. Anybody want to begin by discussing that? An amazing thing to me that every time I ask for a discussion question initially, nobody wants to talk, and then before it's over with, everybody's talking. Debate off. Go ahead, Roger.
I just think there's a lot of people that are motivated by power. They'd work for free if they could boss people around. And that's just not what the Lord had in mind for His church. Is that somebody who would just like to have the power over somebody else is not the right kind of technique.
One of the things that you'll find that is advocated by some today, and we've already made mention of this, but I bring it up again simply because I read yet again a discussion online where this position was being taken, is that elders don't have any authority at all. That they are limited only in exercising oversight by example. In other words, that the way in which elders lead the flock is by their lives, and limited only by their example. In other words, they have no right to tell anyone what to do. I think that that's a kind of a peculiar thing to take that position, but it's taking this passage and it is taking it to an extreme. What Roger touched upon right here, I think, is the most important aspect of this passage, at least in understanding this passage. There is inherent in the position of elder authority. It is seen in the word bishop, for example, which is another term for overseer, one who has oversight in a congregation. So the idea of being an overseer, examples that we find of various qualifications indicate someone who is put in a position to where they make decisions and where they have a leading role in convicting the gainsayer and shepherding the flock. So there is authority that is inherent in such a position. And since that is the case, individuals who desire power would gravitate to that position. That's something that is, you can see this anecdotally in regard to all aspects of our society. You see individuals that when they aspire to the presidency of the United States, and it becomes obvious as you look at them and their behavior and their demeanor that the reason why they want to be president is because they want to be in charge. They want to be in control. They want to be the ones making decisions and calling the shots. And that kind of motivation is something that can be extremely destructive to God's people. An individual who desires to be in charge will be dictatorial in his leadership. He'll be despotic in his attitudes and demeanor and behavior towards his brethren. You'll remember that Jesus, as he was talking to his disciples, and his disciples sought positions of exaltation among themselves. They were saying, who is going to be at the right hand of Jesus, and who's going to be at his left? Jesus basically answered their questions by washing their feet and showed himself no one in authority. No one without Jesus is the one in charge. He has all authority in heaven and earth, and yet he came to serve rather than to be served, and gave his life as a ransom for many, and taught them a lesson. He said the Gentiles love to be lords of one another, but among his disciples it will not be so. And so it is very much a servant leadership. And I think that we can see it anecdotally. When you consider employers and bosses that you have had, there's different kinds of leadership styles. And by far the one that is appreciated most is an individual who is, when work is to be done, he's the first one to roll up his sleeves and get after it. And when there are problems that present themselves, he's compassionate and concerned for the welfare of the worker. And compare such an individual with one who is simply an order giver and an individual who considers himself superior and expresses arrogance and pride, there's no comparison with regard to how those two individuals are appreciated. The one who is the servant leader is the one who is greatly appreciated, and often the work is accomplished and a better job is done as a result of that kind of individual leading in contrast to the despot or the dictator. So we can see it, we understand it. Let's just not go to the opposite extreme and say that an elder doesn't have any authority at all, as some will want to do. So, looking at that, if we were to say the difference between, we could give any number of examples of dictators, of despots, and all we would have to do is compare them to how Jesus led, how he led his disciples, how he submitted humbly to God's will, even to the point of death, and as such serves as a wonderful leader to us. And I think that's the example of servant leadership that we are called to, the same as Jesus. In no way does it deny the fact that Jesus has all authority, but it indicates the type of oversight and shepherding that he gave is something that we should seek to emulate, or elders should seek to emulate as well. Amen?
Earthly examples, in addition to Christ, we all can definitely see that. But I think it was Jesus to... When he came to Jesus asking for him to make his daughter well, he recognized his position under Jesus' authority, but he also acknowledged that he had servants under him. And he said, I say to this one, go and does it. So he was recognizing that he wasn't the top man.
Right.
Even though he had authority. And I think, as we see our elders, we need to see them as, over us. God is the top man.
Yeah. Well, the position of oversight in a congregation is if we use that idea as middle management. In other words, it's you don't set policy. You're the one that simply seeks to ensure that what needs to be done is done. And there are an awful lot of arguments out there with regard to the nature of the elder's authority and what discretion that he has and what he can bind and what he cannot. And I think sometimes people get confused with regard to it and it can become somewhat troublesome. Christ has all authority, and we have revealed to us his will for us. And the elder's place is simply to do what he can to ensure that all follow and heed that. He has no right to go beyond it. And the lording it over is something that would be, again, indicative of determining for self, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it, and it's my way or the highway type of an attitude, and that's something that's completely inappropriate. It is simply to help guide and assist individuals to do Christ's will, and that's what's important. Yes, Mark?
Well, there's a difference between being a manager or supervisor and being a leader, because that's kind of the, if you go do an in-depth study on the eldership in general, or specifically rather, the thing it always comes back to is, you're there to lead others. You're not there to manage. If you look at a shepherd and how they manage their flock, they do it one of two ways. They either watch move sheep from a pasture into some pens. Pushing sheep doesn't work very well. It's kind of like pushing a water pillow around. You push here, it bulges out everywhere else. So, and that's the whole concept everywhere that in Timothy and Titus, you know, talks about elders. And in, here again, it's always weak. And that's the example of leadership that we have.
Good. And when we're talking about leadership as well as submission, we're talking about something that indicates, and of course the Bible very clearly establishes, the concept of free will. When the shepherd walks ahead, the sheep willingly follow. And we talked last week of the text of Hebrews chapter 11, where, you know, looking at it from the part of the person who's in submission, that they are to obey and do so willingly. And do so in such a way as to not cause grief to the individual who is leading. So it's very much a two-way avenue here that we're talking about. In order for an elder to be able to effectively lead, he must have willing followers. And when we as those who are in a congregation submit willingly to the oversight of the elders, it enables them to lead by example. And both things are necessary. So it's the same way with regard to husband and wife relationship, and we've emphasized this a lot. And actually, the relationship, at least with regard to the servant leadership of the home, is ensconced in the husband's and father's position. That very much the same way. In order for it to work, the husband has to love his wife. In order for it to work, the wife has to submit to her husband. If any of those two are lacking, then it's going to be problematic and dysfunctional. And a church that is not dysfunctional, but rather as it should be, has individuals who are willingly following the servant leadership of the elders. And if that's not happening, then it's not going to work. So both have to be in tandem in that regard. Yes, John?
Looking at the passage, verses 2 and 3, the authority to govern is not found in the word oversight, which just means to inspect. The authority to govern is found, if you're reading the King James, it's found in feed. If you're reading the New King James, it's found in shepherd in verse 2, the very beginning, which means to feed, to tend a flock, to keep sheep, to rule, to govern. The elder is to rule or govern the flock of God, and to kind of build upon both Mark and Amy's points. The man of God, or the elder in this case, is not looking, he's not ruling under his own authority. He's ruling under the authority of God, to which he's been entrusted sheep. So, this shepherd does not bear his own authority in this case. Now, some shepherds do have their own authority. If you're looking at the worldly and owners of sheep, the shepherd may be the owner of the sheep, but not in this case. This man is over the flock of God, so he's a hireling. He is not the person that has authority. And when you look at the word Lord, it is to bring under one's power, to subject one's to hold in subjection, to be master of. These men are not the masters. God is the master. So that would be the difference. There is plenty of authority, plenty of governance to go on. It's just whose power are you appealing to? The Lord's or your own?
Yeah, and whenever there is an office of any stature given in the New Testament, this is the point that I've made a number of times in sermons. There is, number one, the authority inherent to fulfill the responsibilities of that office. But there is also a limitation to that authority. It is limited to the work of that office. So, in other words, if as an elder I have authority, an elder has authority, as a preacher I have authority, but it is limited in its nature, and it is specific in its nature, and it has to be accepted and recognized in that regard. And what we have here is, again, as Roger indicated, the danger of individuals desiring this so that they will, in other words, exceed that authority. An explanation as to the nature of it, as leading by example. Cop, you had to...
Be very quickly. It's very disarming to thought, as leading by example, and also instills in the thought teamwork, a very important concept.
Very good, very good, very good point. Quentin?
I was just going to say that, obviously, we answered the question, but, our attitude towards those offices, elders or whatever, we should, thank God that we have somebody, meant to stand in that position, because it's, like the sheep, they follow the shepherd because they know, the shepherd gives them safety, he leads them to food, keeps them safe, and so that's why they follow. They have an admiration.
Right.
Realize the job they do, the position they serve. And I think as Christians, we should, I'm not saying no man's above question, but we should look at it as this is a good person.
The Holy Spirit has established qualifications, and as you look at those qualifications, they identify an individual of high character, spiritual standing, reputation, and the type of individual that other Christians would look to as an example and emulate. And again, that's why you have that flip side of it in Hebrews 13, of individuals who would have the audacity to rebel against an individual in that situation, that they will not have God's approval. It is a natural thing, if you're a faithful Christian, to look to those who have proven themselves and have these various qualifications, and to follow. And again, if it is as it should be, it's a good thing. But sometimes it isn't. Mark.
One thing I was going to point out was, we're in verse 5 of the text. We're pointing to direction to submit to the authority. So it's not so much that the elders that they have authority or don't have authority. We are commanded to submit to them, just as, it's the same. You mentioned about the relationship between husband and wife. This is the exact same symbiotic relationship. Is, we are to submit to the authority of the elders, regardless of, and that's why there's such an admonition against teachers and elders and stuff, is we are to submit to them or listen to them. And if they lead us in the wrong direction, it's not that we're inclined to follow, but they do have greater condemnation if they don't lead in the correct direction.
Okay, good, good. Okay, let's go to question number two, which is going to be continuing our discussion of the eldership and this aspect of service. It is also involved in those first four verses, but in verse 2 of the text, it says that as the shepherd serves as an overseer, it is not by compulsion but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. The question is, how can an elder serve for dishonest gain? In what way could the office of eldership be used for this type or this means?
Go ahead. Why don't you give examples? They can be not really done right now, but they can be paid for what they do.
Okay.
Supported for what they do. And if they're seeking that office strictly for that, that's more of a dishonest gain.
Okay. Yeah. It would be considered dishonest gain if an individual preached for the money, or if an individual served as an elder for the money. In other words, you're not in it with the motive that God desires you to be in it for, and as a result of that, there is deceit that is there. So that would be an example of dishonest gain. What would be another way?
I don't see it in this congregation, but in many congregations, a lot of businessmen that attend congregations and need to know that you can put yourself in a position to further your career in your civilian life by being an elder, by making business deals and, you know, that kind of stuff, by being an elder. That could be a motive for an elder in that situation.
How many times have you seen with politicians or businessmen or something, if they are... their biography is given, that listed prominently as their position as on the board of deacons for, or an elder at, you know, as giving as a one of the ways of saying, hey, I'm qualified and you can trust me, so vote for me, or get involved in business with me. And again, there is, I'm not saying that every time you see that, that's the reason or behind the service, but that is something that could be true. We've got to be very careful. The relationship we sustain as Christians, one with another, is a precious one, and it should never be that we take advantage of that situation, of that relationship. And elders certainly are in a position where they could, if they're not careful. So those who would be motivated to do so, all sorts of damage could be done. Dick?
Yeah, I've heard a case for an elder that. Served a double honor, but he took it upon himself, and every Sunday he'd take $20 out of the plate and put it in his pocket. You know, did that for years, and then he kind of went himself and depended on, of course, paid it all back. But that's one way.
Okay, well, that would be dishonest gain. Yeah, I mean, and there's, and to be honest with you, that's one thing that comes up as you have the first day of the week contribution and the checking accounts and things such as that. There's often the case that an elder will have control of or access to those things, and so just outright grift could be the case. It certainly was the case with regard to Judas Iscariot, who kept the bag. The money bag, and so that was that as well. Mark, you had your hand up?
I was reading an article here a while back. There was a church out in California, I believe it was a big institutional church, and there was two of the elders had embezzled over the course of 5-6 years over $1 million out of it, and they had their own private little vacation home that they had shared, you know, bought together and stuff like that. And it's just like, you know, that was actually the first thing I thought of when I was studying the text. You know, we got to this point. So, is
that an article? That would be an example of it, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Same way of trying to remember that you're not in one business.
Say that again.
You go through some of your members when you go on business.
Okay. Good, good. And there are some who would do such a thing, but that's another example. Yes, Roger.
Well, friends kind of, this is not so much monetary gain, but I think friends kind of ask each other for favors. You know, you help me on some project, I'll help you. And sometimes, I don't know, I kind of have to think about that before I ask somebody to do something for me. I would kind of like for them to do it on a reciprocal basis, not just do it begrudgingly because of, you know, they think, well, I'm the elder. They've got to do it, you know, yeah. If they don't want to. And it's kind of a, I don't know, it's just kind of a, something you have to think about, you know, because you don't want somebody to feel like they're compelled to do something that they don't want to, and then they kind of grumble about it.
And there would be, and that's something important for elders to recognize, because there would be in such a request, inherent in such a request in the minds of some or on the part of some, a feeling of compulsion. In other words, I have to do this because of who he is that's making the request. And so, you know, you're right in too in emphasizing, pointing out the fact that when we talk about gain, dishonest gain, it doesn't necessarily have to be material gain. a monetary gain. It can be simply the gaining of favors or getting your way and utilizing the office in an inappropriate way, influence peddling or coercion, even if it's subtle, is something that would be completely inappropriate. And you have to recognize that anytime you're in a position of authority, whatever that authority may be, if you come to an individual who is in a position of submission, you can take advantage of that situation. And using that for your own gain in any way would be something that would be inappropriate. I think we often think monetarily in regard to this because we can see how those things would happen. But it could be simply the currying of favors by coercion in that regard. Yes, sir. Yeah, those are a couple of examples of monetary gain, and one that Chris mentioned that I think I've seen fairly often as well is where when someone passes away or something, pressure being put upon them to give a portion of the estate to the congregation and pressuring in that way. That would be an example of dishonest gain. Option of those things. Yes, but
I would think also a pride would be a dishonest game of some, you know, some who they want that control. They want to feel like they're somebody important, so that's why they take that position, you know, because then they get puffed up and they, you know, they feel like, well, now I'm important, now I tell people what to do, I have that power. And that's,
well, that's certainly an aspect of the admonition here, that people do not serve for that purpose. Yes, Ron?
We have dwelt extensively on the negative aspect of this, but we've not done anything about the positive. I'd like to say something about the positive. Go ahead. Must be done equally. I really prefer a man who is equal about the job he does as an elder. And we ought to praise such men. They're worthy of praise. So, yeah, I don't want to leave us all negative that. No,
hey, that's my fault, because the questions were negative. So yes, it's important to point out that in order for an elder to be successful in the oversight, it's a work that must be desired. You know, I've seen this quite often when you approach a man to ask if he'll serve. He will, on occasion, with reluctance, say, "Well, if I'm needed, I guess so." You know, and I understand the reason behind that. Humility would be a part of that. I don't want to, but again, the office of elder is one that should be eagerly sought. And when we say eagerly sought and desired, we don't indicate from that that we politic or campaign for it. But a willingness and a desire to serve is something that is actually not only a positive, but a requirement for an individual to serve.
Yeah. When you find a man who meets these qualifications, he doesn't have the negative aspect, but has the positive aspect, you found an exceptional man.
Yeah. Good point.
And he's well qualified.
Good point. Anybody else?
Like the brother was saying, well, you start off with a good example. You know, when you ask the question, the first question, the qualification of an elder, if you have those, you are in that kind of position where you have the good example already there. But if you have been in a congregation where there are no elders versus elders, now in Pine Bluff there were no elders, but while in Houston had elders, there is just a sense of relief. In the congregation where there are no elders, the smallest problem can be so magnified, become so out of hand. And I think Ron is right. We need to think about elders and give them due what's due. And it's wonderful to say that we have elders here that can look out for our benefit and look out for the whole congregation. And not to put themselves above God's standards, because God has set the standards for them. And they have to come within the realms of that. And we are lucky, and thank God that we do have elders here. And other congregations I've been in, because it is something to be in a congregation where there are no elders. It just, you have one true brother will supersede the rest of them, and then they become high up and themselves, well, sometimes above that of an elder. I just came out of Houston and went on this cruise, and one of the things I just want to share this with you all, the young preacher got up and wrote in Bible class and said, we need to do more evangelizing. And he said, this is Sister Washington. He hadn't been at home. But he know when I travel, I have my Bible open out. The driver that Tamita got to pick us up, I said, well, let's have my Bible, because I've got an hour to teach this man if he doesn't know anything. And so I got to talking to him, and the cool thing, we had to spread the word. A lot of these people just don't know. He said, well, you know what? We worship on the Sabbath, but I have my Bible, so I'll just show it to him right here. And he could show it to him. I said, okay, could you tell me what law was given, and when it was given, and the woman's given? And he said, well, sure, it's in Genesis. Law was given in Genesis as wrong. And then I thought about what I need to do with him, to show him where all authority was given to Christ in the last chapter of Matthew. And then I said, don't take him to Acts 27 right now. But you bring him up and go to Galatians and Hebrew, and you talk about the law first, and show him where the law has been about. Then you go to the church and show him the status of the church. And then you go and tell him the date that we should worship on. All that happened, the only thing that he said every few minutes, we worship on the Sabbath. He can show me a scripture. I left with my Bible. I told him, I said, well, look, I'm going to say this and I'm finished. And then I got through with him. I wouldn't get into word, but I said, well, at least I could just study on my own. But we have to give people the word. And I just appreciate you all, elders. And we need to do our part as being members. When I leave here, I'm working. I'm getting ready to go now to Hot Springs, Lord's Village. I'm a little nephew, obey the Gospels in his 50s. And we're going now to see, strengthen him, see what help him with the congregation where he is now. But we have to do work, our work. I can't drive at night. I'm fortunate. I have people that drive me around here to Houston. My daughter's so good, I carry me different places. But I'm doing the work of the Lord, and I would like you all to pray for me, because I run into some people that just are rude and everything else. But I know I'm a saint, and one day I'm going to die, and I'm going to stand before God, and I want to be like Paul. I want to have done my work here on earth. So I do desire to draw each of them people to pray for me in that area, because I do try. But I'm just want elders, I want you to know. That's when I have elders light out of my house. Because I do appreciate you all, and you keep standing strong, because we need you. And Ron is right. Well, sometimes we don't, you know, you just don't know that we think about you. But I pray for you. I pray for everybody here. And elders everywhere, and good sound preachers at Bel Air. Now we got a sister preacher there, and the man is just as strong. And I got them standing by. If you need some help, to help me with the gospel, they are willing to do it. And that's the one thing. All over Hot Springs, everywhere I go, I have people that really will help me. And I got some of these things in the Lord's body still. Don't want to straighten out, but overall, I'm thankful to God. And the elders, I do appreciate it. You're all and I talk about standing. I'll tell them to preach it, and he stands so strong. And he was like, well, you know what? We got a preacher back and forward stand just like you. And that stand up. And we need to talk about our people. We need to let people know that we have good faithful folks. Other folks will whoop us in the head, and we just sit there and sit there. No, I don't. I have the word of God, and I teach people. And we need to do that. You know, let people know that God loves us, and we're doing what's right.
I appreciate that, Samantha. Let's go on to the next question in the lesson. How do we submit to one another? This is a question that is enlarging upon the concept of submission. In verse 5, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. May I introduce this thought myself so that we can pretty much get finished with the study today. The concept of humility, I believe, is what's important there. When I looked at this passage and we discussed it, you'll remember we went to Philippians, the second chapter. I think it serves as a great divine commentary on this concept, where Jesus is used as the example, as the church in Philippi was told to look out not only for your own interest, but also for the interest of others, as Christ did, who was at the right hand of the Father, made himself of no reputation, and came in the form of a servant. And so he submitted himself to the will of God for the purpose of accomplishing God's will. And this idea of submitting to one another is something that can be accomplished when we are humble. We're not concerned primarily, and certainly not exclusively, with our own interests. But we are always concerned about the needs of others and their interests. And as such, we are willing to subjugate self, to lower self, so that the common good can be accomplished. And I think that's the idea. And again, when we're talking about the lives of Christians, we're talking about lives of submission. And it is seen everyone among us just about has an area or realm where they have authority. But more often, there is an area or realm, or realms, plural, to where there is needed submission and humility is the concern here. And that's, I think, why I was involved in that particular text. Anybody want to add anything to that? Yes, Kyle.
Basically, we can help each other by being examples for each other.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Yes, Roger.
I think when we read things like this, we think about submission. That means I have to do everything somebody tells me to do, and I don't think that's exactly the point here. It's you need to do things that are good for other people, not just pushed around by other people, but to seek out opportunities to do good.
Yeah. It's a willingness to be selfless. Is what it is. And again, when we discuss submission to elders. We understand the limited nature of the elder's authority, and if the elder calls you to do something that God would deny or be displeased with, then there is a necessity, a responsibility to resist that. So the idea of submission never is total, except with regard to submission to Christ. There is always a caveat, a limitation to the authority that exists, and those who go beyond their realm will receive God's judgment, but may be resisted righteously by those that they are mistreating or abusing. But this has to do more with our responsibility, our attitude, our demeanor and behavior. And remember in all of this, my responsibility when I come to any relationship that I sustain with another, it's not to make sure that he's doing right. Yeah. And that's the way I've given this illustration from time to time. But there was a lady that I was counseling with regard to a relationship with her husband, and we had some videos we were looking at, and the videos were right on, and she got a lot out of them, I thought, until the end. She said, "You know, this is wonderful." She said, "I wish my husband had been here because he needed to hear that." You know, and my answer was, "Well, you know, you were here, and this is what I wanted you to hear." You know, in other words, you know, it's not going to do much good unless you make the application for yourself. So, you know, too often there is a situation that arises to where you put yourself in the position of the other. I don't like the attitude that person is showing. I don't like the way they approach me. I don't like the way they said what they said. So as a result of me not liking those things, I'm not going to do what I'm supposed to do. Well, that's cutting off your nose to spite your face. You can't think of it in that way. Whenever you are in a position of submission, you have to determine what God requires of you. And look at it from your side of it rather than the other person's side with regard to responsibility. And that's, I think, the emphasis that's placed here. To submit to one another with humility. Okay? All right. The next question that we have is, how do we exhibit sobriety and vigilance? And this is a reference to the 8th verse of the text. Be sober, be vigilant. Vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about as a roaring lion. Be sober. We talked about sobriety is self-control. And vigilance is watchfulness or carefulness. Give me some ways that we can exhibit that. Yes, Dave?
Well, to answer the question there would be by being steadfast and resisting the devil, and as in James 4 and verse 7, by submitting to God and resist the devil, he will flee from you. And of course, the devil takes on many different forms, as a lion, born lion here, and as a wolf in Acts 20, and an angel of light. And to say when, as a born lion, that he fears and everything, but when you resist him, and it says the devil will flee from you, this can come by your pussy. You know, in that sense, he's a coward. He backs off when you resist him. He's waiting for another opportunity to come in, and that. And so the devil is not as strong as you would think, because as a lion, it's only as long as he's able to do that and resist him, he becomes weak. And that.
Okay, good point. One of the things I wanted to bring out is that, you know, basically three things. People, things, and circumstances. Where you go, who you go with, and what's there, or what's going on. You know, talking about the various enticements of life as the things, drink and drugs and sex and all of those kinds of things. The people, the awareness of the fact that evil companionship corrupts good morals. The circumstances, the places that you might find yourself in that will lead to sin. All of those kinds of things are things that we ought to be aware of, first of all. That's where the vigilance comes in. To recognize that the people that we go with can lead us to sin. The things that we do can be sinful. The places we go can lead us into sinful practices, and to be aware of those things, to avoid them. That's the first point. Avoidance is one of the best things that we can do. It's one of the best strategies that we can use to resist the devil. Avoidance. Flee temptation. Flee fornication. Run away from those situations, people, and circumstances that can lead us into sin. Things, people, and circumstances. And then the second thing is, when you find yourself in those situations, to resist. Prayer is a good strategy. Again, when you find yourself in the presence of those things, to run away from them rather than to cultivate the possibility. You know, it's one of those things to where if sin and temptation appalls you, you will turn away from it. Strive to establish a repugnant attitude toward those things that are evil. Never become conversant with and to the point where things are palatable to you, because then that is what will lead to sin. So it's very much an attitude, but it is also one that where we can implement strategies to avoid the devil. And those things are tied in the idea of vigilance as well as sobriety. And then finally, the question, fifth question, just answer very quickly so we'll be able to go on to 2 Peter next week. What does it mean to be perfect as we're established and strengthened by God? I just wanted to make note of that word perfect, indicating not sinlessness, but that as we are established in the things of God, we become mature and complete, capable of accomplishing these things. And that's what he's calling them for in 1 Peter, because of the present persecution. It was going to be difficult for them to live as Christians in that day and time, and as a result of that, they needed to be mature Christians so that they would be able to withstand those things. With God's help, his assistance, we can become mature and strong and complete and be able to accomplish what he desires for us and resist those things that would be detrimental to our standing. That was the second bill, wasn't it? That was the first bill. Okay, we'll slow back down a little bit and let anyone else talk if he wants to, if I got it to the end. Yes, Roger.
I had a comment on that last question just as we read it. I was thinking about something that we have to still have the one time, a good long while ago, there was a guy that ran a gas station, and I bought something there, and he had to undercharge me by a nickel. I told him about the nickel that I still owed him, and he was just all impressed with the honesty, you know. And it struck me as kind of funny that he would make a point over a nickel, but I guess I was making a point over a nickel.
Yeah, sure.
And I said, well, it's really easy to be honest over a nickel, but it's really good practice. Because little things like, you know, you let something like that go in your life, and then the next time maybe you have a chance to overlook a dollar, and then maybe a lot more than that.
Sure.
But if you're honest over a nickel, you may be honest over a dime or a dollar or something worse later on. So it's to kind of make a habit, develop a habit of starting out easy, I guess, over some of these things, over the vigilance.
Okay.
For instance, what kind of movies you go to, what kind of friends you have, and then when things get harder later on, you've got a little practice to.
Good point. Yes, Sam?
The same question first that comes to mind is that you think you can take these lessons home. And I know from my own personal life, there were times when, you know, I thought my court was strong. And, you know, it was tall and it was thick. And especially in certain areas, it just wasn't even tempted by it. But Satan doesn't quit, you know, and he'll take a little chunk off that wall, just even if it's just so small you wouldn't even notice. But over time, he wears down that wall, and you find you can get right in that spot you thought you were strong.
Yeah.
So we have to be constantly, you know, draw near to God, but draw near to you. We learn to have a heart of God. We learn to know and understand what He hates and what He loves, and become like Him. And if we do that,
good. Good point. Thank you very much for your time and attention. We'll pick up with the second epistle that Peter wrote next week.